No further ado, I bring you Gina.
Thank you, Diane, and thank you, everybody. And I'm just going to start by saying that I am both humbled and honored to be standing before you. I consider this a privilege, so thank you for having me. And I'm just going to start by saying, first of all, I'm just going to ask my higher power to use me as an instrument and just lead me in what I should say. So when I was asked to do this a month or so ago to speak to you all, I had my own plans about what I was going to get up here and say and things of that nature. And it was suggested to me that, why don't you speak on something related to the identity papers? And then I said, oh, I'm out of time, and I don't know how I'm going to do all this thing and things of that nature. And then I thought about how I teach part-time. And a lot of times we have discussion forums, things of that nature, and I tell the students, relate your findings to the concepts taught in this course. That's what I tell them. So what I'm going to try to do today is relate my life to the concepts taught in this book as it relates to the identity papers. So that's what I'm going to attempt to do today. So let me just start my timer. Okay, got my bullets here. Okay, first of all, my name is Gina, and I am the adult child of two alcoholic parents. Hi, everybody, and thank you. The first time I heard that presentation like that, my name is whatever, and I'm the adult child of two alcoholic parents. I heard that from a fellow ACA traveler. And the first time I heard her say it, I really didn't get it. And then there came a point where where it was resounding to me when she would say that. And I think to me, because of how I grew up, I learned to minimize a lot of things, you know. I minimized everything. And I thought about it. I'm not just the adult child of one alcoholic parent. I'm the adult child of two alcoholic parents. And for me and for a lot of people, that is quite significant. But anyhow, let me go ahead and attempt to relate this to our book. The identity papers. In our text, on page 84, it says, in childhood, our identity is formed by the reflection we see in the people around us. And for many of us, if we're not from alcoholic homes, we're from some type of dysfunctional home, so we didn't have good models and things of that history, things of that nature. So anyhow, I'm going to start with my family history and just look at addictions on both sides, mental illness, and the family dynamics. My mother, she was one of six girls, and she was exactly a middle child. My mother's father was the alcoholic in their direct household, and my mother was quite a storyteller, and the way I understand it, he was quite theatrical in his behavior. Nevertheless, my mother being the middle child, a lot of the attention was not on her. She had she had two older sisters, one of them which she started having children young. So when you have a child who starts to have children, that's some attention that's taken off of her. And she had two sisters who were younger than her, one of which was always in some type of trouble, and there was a younger sister. So my mother didn't get a lot of attention, and she was responsible for her younger sister. I also heard of things. I mean, I experienced similar things myself. My mother would tell me how she would be on school trips, and she's walking home from school, and there would be her father, the alcoholic, and he's laid out in the middle of the railroad tracks, whatever the case may be. So I can imagine how that might have made her feel. Her school friends and things of that nature, seeing things like that. My father, on the other hand, he was one of three children. Now, my father was also an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic and a drug addict. He was one of three children. And the way I get the story is that his mother was crazy. I don't know if they ever got a definition or a diagnosis of what crazy meant at that point, but what I know was that there came a point when they kept her in a room, and my father's grandparents raised his sister, and his father raised him. Now, my father, who is At this point, I still have my father. I don't have my mother. And my father's now 75 years old. And this is one thing that makes me thankful to be in recovery, because now my father stopped drinking at a point in his life. He stopped drugging at a point in his life. And he's been alcohol and drug free for, I'm going to say, pushing on 30 years. I don't know exactly. But he's never been in recovery. And therefore, my father has a lot of pain that he never dealt with. And a lot of times, I listen to my 75-year-old father go back into his years, and I can hear that pain. And it saddens me that it saddens me for him. But I feel blessed because I have recovery, and I have tools and, you know, the sort of support of so many people. And my prayer is that I'm not 75 years old one day, and, you know, I'm sad about this or whatever the case may be. But so nevertheless, my father quite often, he still talks about the fact that his grandparents took his sister, and they did more for the sister than he did than they did for him. And there was a point where his father raised him, but there was a point where he wasn't working. So my father didn't have certain things. Like, he would literally share, I had holes in my shoes and this and that or the other. The thing about that is, the thing that I'm sad for him about is, there's a lot of resentment there. Between him and his sister, there is a lot of negative energy. And as they're both getting older, I wish it was not there. As a parent and as a human being, that's why I think it's very important with our children not to do all that favoritism stuff and, you know, compete, because a lot of times it's certain things are just kind of hard to let go of. But still, one day I hope that they have a better relationship than they do have. Now, how my mother and my father met. From my understanding is, my mother was 16 years old and she was at a baseball game and she met my father. And they got together and they dated for a while. And I've heard stories of how he would come over and visit. And my father is, a couple of people in this room know my father, but he is he's the life of the party. He always is. He's very talkative. He's a conversationalist and things of that nature. But so I heard stories of how he would come over and entertain the family and things of that nature. But there came a point where they separated. I'm not sure why. But this is where it gets interesting. So my father and my mother split. They separate for whatever reason. My father meets someone else who, as I get the story, is a bit underage. He gets this lady pregnant, and they have a shotgun wedding, and they're married, and they live together, and they have three children, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So let's see how this went. So he's with this other person. They have three children or whatever, but I know this lady, and she's still alive, too, and she is and always has been a little bit dysfunctional. As a matter of fact, I think she's a unique person is what I'll say. But as they were coming up, they were partiers. That my father was, hey, he did it all. If he was right here with you, he will tell you, I did this, I did that. Not that he's proud of it, but he's not going to hide it. You know, he'll tell it like it is. But they partied too much. And they got their children taken away from them on a number of occasions. And there came a point where, so my father, even when he was with my mother, because I'm going to get back to the story, and there's a lot going on here. But as a man, he always thought that it's the woman's role to take care of children. So while he was out, you know, making money or whatever the case he was supposed to be doing, she was supposed to be taking care of the children. That didn't happen a lot. So there came a point when, the way I get the story is, she disappeared for a whole weekend. And the kids were in the house by themselves, and one of the children tried to make dinner. And he was a little bitty, a 4 or 5 year old, and he burned the house. He literally burned the house up. So someone, of course, came and rescued them from that fire. But that was the last time. At that point, I think social service was a bit frustrated with them, and they took their children away. So from that point, I'm not even born yet, but from that point, they're gone. And I don't know if my mother and my father continued to see each other here and there. I don't know. But eventually they got back together. And as far as I can remember, my father was always there. Now, I was born in the 70s. I don't remember my father ever not living with us. But this is what I do remember. First of all, I don't like noise, because there was always a party in my house. There was always alcohol, there was always cigarettes, there was always a card game, there was always music, there was almost always too much activity. And if it was a good night, there was a fight, you know, so there was always something going on in my house. But it came, my father used to work for the steel mills, and he got laid off around 1980, I don't know. Well, they use the word laid off, but if you ask me, when you're laid off, you're supposed to get called back to work. He never got called back to work, so I don't know what that was about. But my point is, I don't remember my father ever working. My mother provided for our household, and to be quite frank, we were on public assistance. My mother did a lot of things. As I tell you about my mother, she did a lot of things to take care of other people. She always put other people before herself. And I got the facts. As I grew up, I began to ask questions. Well, Mom, why didn't you do this and why didn't you do that? So my mother decided that she was never going to pursue my father for child support because then he'd have to take care of those other three kids that he was supposed to take care of. But the thing about it is she took care of all of us on welfare. And for a while, we lived in some pretty crappy houses. Yes, we did. Whatever you see on TV, I've lived in it. I've lived in roaches, I've lived in mice, I've lived in all of it. But nevertheless, my mother, and I think she got this, I noticed a lot of generational things on both sides of my family. Now, when my mother was coming up, she, you know, she took care of her sisters and things of that nature. As a matter of fact, one of her sisters passed away. My mother always raised everybody else's children. So for the most of our lives, we lived in two or three bedroom apartments, but there was always somebody else's children, somebody else living with us, or whatever the case may be. And my mother was quite often taken advantage of because she felt like she was supposed to take care of everybody. This is what my mother said I was supposed to do. So people lived with her, they didn't contribute to the household, and that's kind of just how it went. Let me see here. I don't know why. Well, I think I know why. I think many of us were taught that it was our mother who was supposed to take care of us. It was our mother who was supposed to love us and nurture us and things of that nature. I figured it out later on in life that my mother, people can't give you what they don't have. That is just a fact. My mother couldn't take care of me. My mother was totally emotionally unavailable. As a matter of fact, as a child, while I was looking for love from her, she was looking for love from other people. She certainly was. My mother had a younger sister. As a matter of fact, this was the baby of the family. And first of all, she was the center of attention. She was negative energy. She was I don't even know what that relationship was, but my mother felt that if she owed herself to her sister. This is my baby sister. I'm supposed to take care of her. And my mother used to drink to the extent that she was literally a sloppy drunk. My mother would get so drunk that she would fall out in the middle of the floor, whatever the case may be. And I don't understand her way of loving. Sometimes they say my mother loved to the point. She literally loved to the point that it hurted. And I can remember times, this auntie, she just treated people like that. Not only my mother, her children and everybody else. She would literally, you know, just, she was very abusive. She would beat her children. She would curse out people or whatever the case may be. And my mother would get drunk enough that she would be so sloppy. I actually saw her kick my mother and, you know, spit at my mother, whatever the case may be. And I didn't understand why my mother would let people treat her like that. I never understood that, other than the fact that this is my mother, and I probably told my mother that I was going to take care of her, and I'm going to stand by my word, and that's what I'm going to do, you know. And so that is what she did. So anyhow, all of this, what I'm going to refer to as noise, because that's what it was to me, that went on in my house. I grew up a very introverted child. I was a very fearful child. I was a very spacey child, and I disconnected. I disconnected from people. I had very poor social skills because when you feel like your own mother doesn't pay you any attention, I kind of felt like nobody liked me, nobody loved me, all of those things. And I carried that with me for a while. Let's just say for the first 2 decades of my life, I was a walking bucket of shame. That's just the perfect example of what I was. So literally my family and my cousins always lived with me, so older cousins included. Most of the time there would be a card game or something like that going on in the house, and I didn't want to be a part of that. So I would go in a back room or something like that, and I would be in my head. I stayed in fantasy land so much that there was a point where I could not come out of fantasy land. You know, I just stayed in my imagination way too much. And as an adult, that scared me because I didn't know how to come out of that. But in the back room with the lights off, I had my own normal family in my head where I would go and just hang out with them while the other family was up front doing what they did. And so dysfunction. The adult and the teenagers, they drank together, they smoked together, they did all these things together. And I can remember, most people have better legacies than this, but I can remember a cousin of mine saying, my mother was an alcoholic, my father was an alcoholic, so I'm going to be an alcoholic. That was his legacy. He spoke that, and he was an alcoholic. For me, I don't know what turned me... Let me think about that. What turned me off from alcoholism? All I know is it was noise. That's the best definition I can give it. I just didn't want to be bothered with all that activity, all that noise, and the negativity that came with it. I tried alcohol. It was nasty to me. It's still nasty to me. I just don't do alcohol. And as a matter of fact, as I grew up, I had two prayers to God. One of them was, and this is just my stuff. I'm just talking about my stuff. I don't mean to offend anybody. One of my prayers was, Lord, never let me be an alcoholic. And the second prayer, when I became a mother, and this is how I learned to give grace to my own mother, Lord, don't let me let this child end up to hate me. Because as I grew up, you turn out to be like the people who are around you. My mother was my model. And as much as I say, I don't understand why she did this, and I don't understand why she did that, I was a whole lot like her. But anyhow, before I go there, let me talk about school. So in school, again, I was very, my daughter told me when she was younger, and she might have been in the fourth grade or something like that, children have their own stress. Kids have their own stress. That is so true. Kids have their own stress. So I was in school a lot of times, and I just could not concentrate for the life of me. I was at home. I had problems in my mind. I could not concentrate on anything that was going on. And I can remember one or two times I'm in school, and the teacher's going over whatever, and I'm just staring straight out at the, I don't even know what I'm staring at. She might have been lecturing for an hour, and I'm just staring for an hour. So on one or two occasions, she called me up to her desk, and she's asking me, what's going on with you, and what are you staring at, and what do you see there? And I remember one time she did the little space Martian thing. She said, what do you see there, little people? And she's going, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But I'm like, you know, what? After I thought about that, I'm like, in later years, I thought, what if she would have interceded on that? What if she would have reported that to somebody, the fact that I spaced out in class so much? And I literally would come to school. I'm not lying. First of all, I was late almost every day. And there were times when I came to school, not because I was hungry, just because I was from a dysfunctional family. I would come to school at almost, it's 11 o'clock. It's close to lunchtime. I was just always late. So I wondered why she never, no, I wonder what would have happened if she had reported these things. And what I had ended up in foster care like my siblings did and things of that nature. And I don't know, but I think everything happens as, you know, I have a higher power. His name is, you know, I call my higher power God. But I think everything played out exactly as it should have played out. One of the most defining moments of my life was... So let's just say there were 31 days in a month. And I'm going to literally say my mother was probably drunk for 25 days of those months. So one day, me and my family, we went on a ride. We went to a beach or whatever the case may be. And we came back and we parked outside of the house. And we're just sitting there talking. At this age, I might have been 8. I'm going to say something like that, 8. And the next thing I know, I looked over to my right. This is something that I don't like to talk about. I'm not going to stand up here and cry, so I'm going to say that to trick my mind, and I'm not going to sit here and cry. But I looked to my right, and my mother was literally laid out on the ground. And then I began to see people run from every direction. People were running. And so I looked over to my right, and she's laying on the ground. So I think, oh my God, my mother is dead. What am I going to do? And I think about what are my options. I have this aunt who's evil and probably going to mistreat me for the rest of my life, like the wicked stepmother, but I don't have the wicked aunt. Or I have this father who already has three children who he doesn't take care of anyway. So what in the hell is going to happen to me? This is how I'm thinking with an eight-year-old mind. What type of stress is this for an eight-year-old? Okay, so I've already played out all these catastrophes in my mind as a child, but the irony of this story is she's drunk, she gets up, and the ambulance is there, or there, whatever the case may be, and she's drunk. Get off me. Let me off of here. Let me go. And she's doing her whatever the case may be. But how that happened was that the bottom drawer was jammed. And my mother, in her drunk mind, she decided that she was going to climb down from the patio so she can go down and open the door. The door was jammed. I don't know how she thought she was going to get in it. But from that situation, my mother, she maimed her leg. My mother never walked right again. And just a lot of other things. But the funny thing about it was, my mother might have been in the hospital for a week, maybe two. Instead of people coming over the house with cards and food and things of that nature that you do when people are sick, you know what they bought her, right? They bought her alcohol. And they said, come here, have a drink of this. This will calm your nerves down. Stop worrying about this and stop worrying about that. So it was amazing to me. As children get older now, they get their own mind. So I'm looking at her, and I'm like, that's my timer. Okay, I'm going to wrap it up. What does it take to make a person stop drinking? Because she could, I mean, you could have died, you know, whatever the case may be. But that didn't make her stop drinking. I'm going to say she stopped drinking for 3 weeks. That's the best I'm going to give her. And she went right back to drinking. Not only that, so this happened on my block. So I went to school the next day, and whenever the kids, oh, her mother, she tried to commit suicide and blah, 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 blah. That wasn't the case, but that's how the story played out. So anyhow, that's kind of how that went. But so in school, I was always just had too much in my mind. So I was always either a below average student or C's or D's is the best I could do, had too much in my mind. But let my mother tell the story. She would tell family, oh, she does great in school. She gets A's and B's and all this type of stuff. And I had more enemies than enough in my family because my mother's telling me, telling other people she has A's and B's. I don't know why. I never failed a grade, but I had cousins who failed repeatedly. So that wasn't a good thing to go around telling them that I got A's and B's all the time. Now, my mother would try to help me with school, but certain things, she wasn't good at it. My mother would yell at me through an assignment. This would be the assignment. No, this is not how you do this. You don't understand this. This is how she would fight. My father would come along, and he never helped me with anything, but he had his way of cursing. My father never used a real curse word at me. And, oh, you don't understand that. You all Rudy poop. That's his curse word, you know. But still, no one wants to be hollered at all the time. So I didn't like homework time. I didn't like school or any of that different type of stuff. As a teenager, I was just very depressed, very disconnected, and all of that. As a mother, and I'm moving too fast, the one thing I don't understand is, I'm not going to exaggerate here, I slept an awful lot. I slept all the time. And I don't know why my mother ever thought that there was nothing wrong with that. She never thought it was anything wrong with the fact that I laid on the couch all day long. But she never really tried to help me. I get it now. My mother, you know, she had her own stress going on in her life, and she really just could. She was probably overwhelmed with her own things and couldn't help me. But I just never understood why she just really never tried to get me any type of help, because I was really, really a depressed kid. But my mother would say things like, first of all, I wasn't a bad kid. I never really got any major trouble. I was a disconnected kid. That I was. So she would say, ain't nothing I can do with this girl. I haven't tried. I can't do nothing with this girl. But the girl wasn't doing nothing. She really wasn't doing anything. So I get that now as an adult, but back then, I didn't get that. So 11th grade comes around, another defining moment. My mother gets sick again, and she's back in the hospital, alcohol-related. And you know how you're outside of a room and you can hear the doctor talking? And I heard the doctor saying to her, I forget exactly what percentage, but you have ruined a certain percentage of your liver. And if you don't stop drinking like this, he's telling her, you're going to be dead, and blah, 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 blah. So here I am, but this time I'm in 11th grade. I'm not exactly so little, but still, I don't want my mother to die. So I'm like, okay, now what is she going to do now? But I think he scared her that time. So in that instance, she did stop drinking. She never got into a program, but she did stop drinking at that time. And I'm very thankful for that. I am so thankful for that. I wish that we all, myself included, more often than not, learn from other people's mistakes, because although I don't understand everything about addictions, I have seen addictions take life. I have literally seen it. I've lost 4 family members to addictions, and I've lost 3 of them violently. So I'm thankful that there came a point where she did stop drinking. But nevertheless, let me just wrap this up. As a young adult and a mother, in high school I met my daughter's father, who, first of all, I never thought that people just genuinely liked me. So although I had dated guys before in the past, whatever the case may be, I didn't understand why he just genuinely liked me. You don't like me, you know. He didn't have any motive in why he liked me. So for me, he was a safe place. And he rescued from me for all the craziness that was at home. So to make a long story short, this is the man that I married. This is the man that I had my daughter with and all those good things. But there were a lot of things that I didn't even know about him. So they tell us that we are comfortable with things that we are familiar with. So he was familiar to me, and I didn't even know it. But it turned out that he was an alcoholic just like everybody else in my family. He fit in just well with the family members. And he was also a obsessive liar. And I mean, you've heard people say if they're talking, they're lying. He was one of those people that if he was talking, he was lying. And as a parent, the one thing about me was that my maternal instincts were always on. As a parent, he'd done certain odd things that would make me uncomfortable for the safety of my child. So there came a point where, and I'm not going to say it was me. He was actually in the military, and there came a point where he was deployed for something, whatever the case may be, and it gave me a chance to think, and that's all I needed. So anyway, I filed for a divorce and things of that nature. And as a matter, that's when I started getting my life back together, as a matter of fact. I went back to school. I went back to college. And I'm going to just whine about just a little bit. When I was in high school, 11th grade year, it occurred to me that pretty soon I was going to be graduating. And I knew that I had to have a way to take care of myself. My mother couldn't take care of me because my mother lived off of a disability check. So she couldn't take care of myself. But I'm saying this to say, all of my life, I got D's and F's. But when it hit me that I'm ready to apply myself, I really applied myself. And in 12th grade, when they had the graduation ceremony, I got so many different awards that I was mad at myself for all the times that I could not apply myself. Nevertheless, so after I had my daughter, and I'm divorced now, I go back to college. I did extremely well in college. The thing about it is, I was never dumb. I was never stupid. I was preoccupied with all the problems that were in my life. But even in saying that, with a child and with all that I had been through, I was emotionally unavailable to my child, just like my mother was emotionally unavailable to me. The blessing in that is, although my mother never tried to help me, maybe she did not know how to help me. I don't know what that was. I stopped trying to figure it out. But my mother was there for my child. That's the blessing in that all. I was not. I just could not do it. I was clocked out totally. Even though I enjoyed going to school, I appreciated the opportunity of going back to school. The truth of it was, going to school was a way for me to run. I was hiding in school, too. I was absolutely hiding in school. I worked full-time. I went to school full-time. And when I got home, I didn't know what to do with this kid. You're supposed to play with the kid? I never learned how to play. I learned how to be stressed out. Worry about my problems. You're bringing me this doll. You want me to play dolls with you? It was just way too much. But so as she grew up, as a matter of fact, there came a point in the first time I really heard about 12-step programs was in college, because I went to school to be an addiction counselor so I can save all those people and they don't have the life like I had. Right? So just to give you a dab into that story, I did it for about a year, and then I realized that I can't. It's so many people have so many issues. It was a lot. So I help people in a different way now. But so I heard about 12-step programs in college, and I couldn't find one. I looked for ACOA. I looked it up on the website, and I just couldn't find it. I think this is how it played out. In 2003, I found an ACOA. I just went, you know how you can look at a website every now and then, go back every few months. So one day I went, and there was a meeting listed. And I said, I'm going to go to this meeting. And the funny thing about it was, on that Thursday, which was the night of the meeting, it was my mother's birthday. So I said, what am I going to do now? I can't go to this meeting. It's my mother's birthday. I got to be there for my mother's birthday, right? But call it selfish as you may, but in that instance, I decided to put myself first. And I went to my first ACOA meeting on my mother's birthday in 2003. And what I did was I gave my father money to take my mother out. You guys go have yourself a good time. I didn't tell them what I was doing because for me to admit to my family that I got issues and I'm not right in my head or my emotions, it would have been insulting. It probably would have been a fight. So I went to ACOA for years, or 12-step programs for years. My mother just died in 2011. I don't think she knew that I ever went to a 12-step meeting. But so I went to my first meeting, and my first experience in ACOA, it was a good one for me because I never knew that I had a right to be angry. And the truth about that meeting was, it was an angry meeting. And there were a lot of people there sharing about, my parents did this, my parents did that, and my parents did this. And I never knew I had the right to be upset, you know. And that was okay for me a while because I needed to voice certain things. I never knew that I could talk about things, tell the truth about things and things of that nature. So, but there came a point where I got all my gripes out. Yep. And I said it was your fault. And I said you didn't love me enough. You didn't love me the way that I needed you to love me. But in my opinion, that group never moved a step two. Okay, I said it. They didn't do the best they could. But what's next? Are we going to sit here and just keep on having a bashing party week after week? And that group did. And it didn't work for me. So that particular group, I left. But since 2003, I've never been without a 12-step program. And I don't want to stand before you and talk about other 12-step programs, but I have every 12-step program that I qualify for, I have been a part of. I've been a part of ACOA. I have been a part of Al-Anon. And the blessing about Al-Anon for me is that when I went to ACOA and Al-Anon, I was still in my 20s. I was young. And those young people, I'm sorry, those little, I'm going to call them older ladies, because they were 40, 50, 60, they were older than me. And they would say, you're so lucky to have found recovery so young in your life. And I would get so mad because when you are in a total state of despair, you can't see the light at the end of the tunnel. You're telling me, oh, you're just so lucky. And I just could not see it. Lady, I'm just happy. If they would have just left me in my pity party, I would have been okay with that. But to tell me week after week, you're so lucky. But I learned a lot from them. So I did ACOA. I did Al-Anon, I did Emotions Anonymous, I did Codependence Anonymous, and I've even done Open, AA, and NA, and anywhere that I can get help, I would get help. I was desperate. There came a point, and it was in college. College was transforming for me because I've always felt like something was wrong with me. And there came a point that I wanted to help myself, but I didn't even know how to help myself or where to start to help myself. So when I finally found recovery and it was the only thing that would help me, you couldn't tell me that I wasn't going to a meeting, because yes, I was. As long as I had a car and gas in it, I have went to a meeting that was 25 and 30 miles away from me. I don't care. You know, that's how important it was to me. I saw therapists. The thing about it is, I'm a very functional person. I mean, I have a professional job, and I seem to have a functional life. You know, I do the things that most people do. I pay my bills, and I have a car, and I have a house, and all those functional things. So when I would go to see therapists, as a matter of fact, to paraphrase them all, what's wrong with you? Why are you here? That would get out under my skin. I have this one therapist, and she would actually tell me, oh, I just love it when you come. I just love to hear you talking. You're so cultural, blah, 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 blah. And she would really get on my nerves because I'm not paying you to entertain you. I really do have, you know, I had problems, but I think, you know, it's just like we went to a retreat not too long ago, and they used masks, and the mask that we wear. And on the outside, on the front of the mask is the outside person, that happy, positive person that most of us know how to be. And the flip side of that is, on the inside, I'm always sad and I feel empty and blah, 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 blah. So then there's this other therapist who tells me, there's nothing wrong with you. The man made me watch The Wiz over and over. You know The Wiz with Michael Jackson? He made me watch The Wiz over and I didn't get it. And, you know, his only point was, everything that you need is already inside you. 10 years ago, that makes sense to me now. But back then, early in recovery, you can tell me that everything that I need was already inside me. It wasn't. I didn't have the tools. I didn't have a program. Nobody put it inside me. It had to be developed. At that point, it was not inside me. I had to do the work. It's been a journey. So, I mean, everything that I could think to do to help myself when I was able to, I tried to help myself. I got scared into just my mother, threats of death scared her into trying to live right. My daughter, when she was 12 years old, to tell you the truth, she walked out the door on me. She was sick of me. So, to tell you the truth, I was a screaming, ranting, raving mother. And one day, I don't know what we was arguing. I could have been yelling at her about anything. It could have been a dish. I don't know. It was anything. But she just picked out. She said, I'm sick of this. And I'm just leaving. And she got up and walked out the back door. And I'm watching her walk down the drive. I'm like, where is she going? And eventually, I go after her. But am I that bad? It was a wake-up call for me. Am I that bad that I'm running my old child away? So, sometimes, I don't know, that just made me even harder deal with my thoughts and my emotions. I used to have she was a grand sponsor, and my sponsor would do what her sponsor did. She would call me and she'd say, how you feeling? Yeah, I'm feeling okay, blah, blah, blah. How you thinking? And I didn't really get why she would always ask me, how am I thinking? And the point was, a lot of times we have a lot of negative thinking going on in our heads. You're trying to get me to check my thinking. But if you can control the way you think, a lot of times you can control the way you act. So once my daughter did that, I would start catching little things, because the bottom line, I think most parents, even my mother didn't know how to love me. She didn't have it in her to love me, but I think she loved me. I think she did. I'm quite sure she did. And I didn't want to see my daughter walk out the door on me. And not only that, there came a point that my daughter, could have been me, could have been her life. It was probably school. She said, Mommy, I think I need to see a therapist. Now, if that wasn't a blow, that to me said, you are just the worst mother. You are a terrible mother. You just screw up everything. But it wasn't about me. It was about her. It may have offended me, and it may have been the truth, and may have not been the truth, but I had no right to withhold that from her. Looking back, I am so thankful that I allowed her to see a therapist, because we got healthy together. And she doesn't have to. Hopefully, she won't have to go through all that I went through, all that her grandmother went through. So I'm thankful for that. and the bottom line was, so let me just go ahead and just wrap this up. I was only trying to, my point today would just be that I didn't know that I could be happy. I really didn't. There was a point in my life where I never thought I was going to have a happy day. Really, the whole darn world was dark to me. I didn't know people could like me. I didn't know people could love me. And now, on many occasions, I'm happy. On many occasions, I enjoy my life. On many, I have good friends. I have people who care about me. And I know this, and I don't question it. And I'm thankful for it. So I was going to talk about some of the things that helped me throughout the programs. And really, what happened, it really was the program, for real. It was, you know how they say, keep coming back? It was sitting in the meetings week after week that helped me. It was listening to you all that helped me. It was some of the literature that helped me. It was learning to control my stinking thinking that helped me. It was surrounding myself with positive people and things of that nature that helped me. So, I mean, it was so many things, but I don't think I could have done it without 12-step program. I don't think I could have done it without ACOA. I don't think I could have learned to love myself and other people in a healthy manner without ACOA. And for that, I am very grateful. So my theme was to be, they asked me one day, so what do you want the theme of your, when you get up to speak, what's your theme going to be? The discovery of recovery. Because without recovery, I just don't think I would have had a quality of life. And I can't tell you how grateful I am to be alive and have no quality. I've been there, done that. It's for the birds. So I'm just thankful for it. I just want to just, one of the promises, and that's promise 12, gradually with our higher power's help, we will learn to expect the best and get it. I never thought that I would expect the best. For me, I didn't think I was worth anything. So to expect the best, these days I do expect the best. And in most cases, I get it. And just to put this back to the identity papers, which is what I was trying to do, on page 84, the identity paper says, we stop believing we have no worth and start to see our true identity reflected in the eyes of other adult children as the strong survivors and valuable people we actually are. So once upon a time, I thought I had no worth. But today I know that I have worth, and today I can love myself, I can love other people, and I have a happy, healthy quality of life, and I owe that to ACA and 12-step programs and to all of you, and for that I am thankful, and thankful that you let me stand before you today. So thank you.